I'm Katie, mom to two littles and four angel babies.
And I'm Sarah, an advocate for moms and children of all backgrounds and family types.
With two PhDs between us and collective decades spent unraveling how society shapes women's experiences, we're here to shred the rule books and their relentless tide of expectations. In this safe space, the complexities of motherhood find the candid, unfiltered voice. We're Undefining Motherhood, one conversation at a time. Have you ever noticed how harsh the medical language is when it comes to infertility, pregnancy, birth, loss? I'm looking at you, incompetent cervix, lazy ovary, blighted ovum, implantation failure, failure to progress. The list goes on and on. And here's what makes it even worse. Studies have shown that doctors who use and encounter stigmatizing language are more likely to have increasingly negative attitudes toward their patients. This has a direct negative impact on patient care, an especially big problem since it's almost impossible for care providers to avoid this language because it is literally encoded in their lexicon. Phrased more simply, language appears in your medical charts based on codes that represent words and phrases, and your care providers cannot influence those codes, even though studies show that their attitudes toward you as a patient are influenced by them. You see where I'm going with this? I've heard time and again from women in this community how they felt dismissed by their medical providers because of the language they used during pregnancy loss, fertility treatments, pregnancy, labor and delivery, or even postpartum. Recent efforts by the company Peanut have shown that change is possible. And to achieve it, we have to keep talking about the problem and providing solutions. In today's episode, we're looking specifically at words that are used to discuss female reproductive bodies that are at odds with women's experiences, often leaving them feeling blamed, shamed, and honestly, even a little bit dehumanized. We share our stories, our research, and some frustrating tidbits of history to discover how we got to this point and where we can go from here. This is important, not just for you, friend, but for your friends, your daughters, your granddaughters, and so many generations to come. The words we use to talk about women's reproductive bodies, they're often so sweet culturally, right? The pregnancy glow, the baby bump. But in medicine, moms are subjected to language that is downright degrading.
Yep.
And it is just, it is so not okay. And it's something we really need to be talking about. So this is something I studied when I was working on my PhD. But kind of like we said in some of our last episodes, I thought, well, this was 150, 200 years ago. Surely things are better now.
Right.
And then I entered the world of trying to conceive, of recurrent miscarriage. And I think there, while the language around women's reproductive bodies, women's bodies in general, is pretty rough medically, I think there's a special kind of horrificness when it comes to fertility and pregnancy. And I have a lot of theories on why, and maybe we can get there. Let's get there. I think it's because of the power that women have to reproduce. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah. You know, when these words were being created and used regularly was when medicine was sort of formalizing itself a little more. There had always been different types of medicine, but it's getting more formalization. We're in a lot of like 1700s, 1800s, and, you know, there were big pushes for things like using male doctors instead of using female midwives because women couldn't become doctors. So midwifery was the way that they went. Even at times when it was actually less safe to give birth in hospitals, because we didn't know about things like washing our hands. So I've always wondered if maybe there was a little bit of this fear of reproduction and the fact that, like, women could do this thing that, yes, they needed the man for, but the man couldn't do it, and maybe that played a role. So, you know, there are a lot of words that we could talk about in women's bodies, but I really want to talk about the reproductive ones because they're rough. Like, they're special.
How did you learn about them, Katie?
Okay. So I'm actually going to save the worst story of this for next week's episode because my personal story is just it's what you need to hear to understand why we're talking about what we're talking about next week. But I will tell you, it's also why we're talking about what we're talking about today. And so basically, what I have experienced in my personal reproductive journey and in working with thousands of moms through Undefining Motherhood is that they're hearing language that makes them feel like failures. And I get it. It makes them feel blamed. It makes them feel judged. And so we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I know that in my own journey, like, with our reproductive endocrinologist, I get called, if I were to get pregnant, it would be a geriatric pregnancy, or it's advanced maternal age.
Advanced maternal age, yeah. Geriatric pregnancy. Do you think advanced maternal age is better than geriatric pregnancy?
I don't know. They both sound really terrible.
I know. They're really terrible. So here's
it just makes me feel like a grandma.
It's interesting that you mentioned geriatric pregnancy and advanced maternal age, because what these phrases are showing us is that there actually is room for change.
Mm-hmm. And there has been some.
And that's part of the reason we're recording this episode and all of the episodes where we're going to talk about these words, right? Because we want to contribute to making that change and to making care better for women. So there are kind of two places where we really care. I mean, there are a lot more than two places where we care about change and this lexicon. But the two main places that sort of matter in terms of especially new doctors who are learning the ropes and the words that they're using are from ACOG. That's an acronym we're going to be using a lot. It's the American Academy. It's the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And they have a dictionary of terms that they use that makes it easy for communicating with other providers and charting and making sure that, you know, everyone is on the same page. And then there's another called the ICD-11, and that's actually what's used for insurance coding. So actually, ACOG has said we no longer prefer geriatric pregnancy or advanced maternal age. We prefer pregnancy after 35. And that came directly from a change maker that was when the Peanut app put out their renaming revolution in 2021.
Right. It went viral.
It went viral. And it went through all of these words, some of which we're going to talk about today. But so far, that's the only one that's changed. And it has changed according to ACOG, but it has not changed in the ICD-11. So you might have doctors who are trying to adopt these recommendations because many doctors are trying to be more patient-centered.
But they can't chart them because then your insurance wouldn't understand what
exactly.
They're
talking about. Exactly. And so for you, for example, as a first, hopefully, full-term pregnancy, your insurance coding would say, and I'm going to use notes. We're actually going to use notes this whole episode because this is really important and we want to just make sure all the details right for you, would be called early preemie gravida.
First time 35 plus pregnancy.
Yep. And then I think it would change to multi gravida if you have had multiple pregnancies. So all that to say, there is change that can be made. That's part of why we're having this conversation. But ultimately, we want to look at, you know, how this lexicon is blaming women for things that are out of their control. It's making them feel like failures if they don't live up to some arbitrary standard set by some medical doctor 200-300 years ago who was male by default.
Of course, yeah.
Because women couldn't be doctors. And it's just language that's at odds with our lived experience. And that was really my experience and something that we're going to talk a lot about next week. And we've even seen there's recent research that says this does contribute to poorer patient outcomes. It does contribute to poorer medical care and patient-centered care. So this is really important. So let's talk about some of these terms, right? Because people are like, okay, well, you keep saying this, but what words are you talking about? All right. So one of my least favorite, I can't even say least favorite, they're terrible. For me, one of the worst, incompetent cervix.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you just woke up one day and decided to be incompetent.
Incompetent. We're going to talk more about that specific one later in this episode. All right, what's one for you?
Lazy ovary. She's so lazy
when one of the ovaries produces fewer follicles and eggs than other ovaries. She's so lazy. Hostile uterus.
Hostile. Love it.
I was never given that diagnosis, but I could have been. For sure. My doctors were just kinder to me.
Love that.
Than that. But not all doctors are.
Okay. Got a hard one for you.
Oh.
Fetal demise means stillbirth.
Fetal demise for stillbirth. And, you know, the thing to know about stillbirth is that when someone has a stillborn baby, they still give birth. They have to give birth to that baby. Mm-hmm. And yet the language is not even talking about it as if it's a baby, but the mom has to go through labor, and she is usually induced. And I mean, now we have a practice where a lot of parents will do photography sessions with their babies, which I highly recommend to people we work with because it can be so supportive later. And I mean, they've been carrying these babies for anywhere from 20 to 40 weeks to get that particular diagnosis. And yet the language doesn't even acknowledge the baby as a person.
It's so clinical
and cold. Oh my gosh. The one we've already hit on, geriatric pregnancy, of course. And then one that is one of my personal least favorites because of my personal experience, products of conception. Mm-hmm. So when I had multiple miscarriages, I had to have surgery for one, but even after the other ones, we had to do ultrasounds. And they're like, we need to make sure that we have retrieved all of the products of conception. They were talking about
Your baby.
My baby.
Yeah.
My baby. And tissue.
Right.
But mostly they're talking about the baby.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Any other ones?
I noticed a lot of adjectives like poor. Mm-hmm. So putting the word poor before something is very common. Also failed or failure.
Yes.
Is really common.
Failure is a really common, and that gets into things like the medical term for miscarriage is abortion, and there can be things that about like a failed abortion, if perhaps a missed miscarriage, where you have a woman's body has not completely expelled that pregnancy. There are a lot of words around failure. And I think that really is what gets to the problem with this, right, that we really want to focus on today. We could write a whole book about this, like, easily. But the main things that really stand out to me are that, one, these words are blaming women for things that are out of their control. They're calling them incompetent, lazy, failures. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't control them. Number two, it suggests a failure of the woman's body for not carrying a pregnancy absolutely perfectly, which goes back to that same idea we've been talking about, right? Womanhood equals motherhood. And so you are failing
at your job.
Way that makes you feel shameful. If anything goes wrong, not even if you don't conceive or carry, but if anything goes wrong, you know, we can do a cerclage. And in most cases, that is going to resolve the problems for people with incompetent cervix, as long as they have the diagnosis early enough. But we're still calling their cervix incompetent. And it really just reduces the struggle that women face, you know, it's just so clinical. We're at real odds with the emotions of what women are experiencing and the clinical language. And ultimately, like, it's just so horrifically dismissive. Mm-hmm. Mm. So dismissive. And so as researchers of words and women.
This is our jam.
This is our stuff.
I dress comfortably today.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to feel cozy to be able to have this conversation. So
I'm
get
professional.
You are a professional. It's an interesting choice. We're gonna get comfy here, and this one's gonna be fun. So get comfy with us, friend. Grab your coffee.
Buckle.
You're gonna need it. This episode is sponsored by G8 by SNP Therapeutics, providing genetics-powered nutrition tailored for every stage of the fertility, pregnancy, and postpartum journeys. Imagine a world where mothers have more control over their health and their baby's development, where maternal health isn't just a hashtag, it's something that really matters. This is the dream G8 is turning into a reality. Through personalized nutrition insights, G8 helped me learn exactly how my body processes and struggles to process different essential vitamins and nutrients. This episode is sponsored in part by the Expecting an Organized Pregnancy and Baby Planner by Undefining Motherhood. When I created this planner, it was because I knew that something had to change. I was in the trenches of new motherhood after years of infertility and recurrent pregnancy loss, and I felt like I was drowning. That fear I'd felt to plan during pregnancy, terrified Jack would never get to come home with us, had left me paralyzed. I went in to be induced, still saying, if we get to bring him home. So the paradigm shift of suddenly having a tiny human to care for, it left me treading water, barely staying afloat. Why hadn't anyone told me the truth about what I needed to know to bring home a baby? As long as you have diapers and a safe place for him to sleep, you'll be fine, people had assured me. I felt like I had straight up been lied to. Where were the voices telling me how to prepare to care for myself during the biggest transition of my life? Why had so many people made registry lists of all these items, but not told me when or how to use any of them, or even how to know if I personally needed them at all? Couldn't someone have taught me about creating stations around my house so I had what I needed when and where I needed it? Couldn't they have told me how to set up a support system so I didn't feel so alone in these deep, dark waters? That is why I created Expecting and Organized. In this book meets planner-organizer combo, you get handheld support to help you prepare for the pregnancy, birth, and postpartum you want and deserve, not for the one everyone says you should have. We've supported nearly 20,000 moms so far and receive rave 5-star reviews for good reason. Because, friend, there's nothing out there like this. I made what I needed and what you deserve. Check it out at shop.undefiningmotherhood.com and use code podcast for 10% off. So words that blame women, even if they don't mean to. Obviously, we cannot cover all of them today in a 45-minute podcast episode. We may be in, 200 hours of documentary programming.
Everyone would be really tired of us.
Oh, my God. No one wants to hear that. No one wants to hear that. So we are going to break this down, I think, in two main terms for this time in future seasons. We can totally do others. So if there are others,
we want to hear from you.
Yeah, definitely. Like, talk to us. Let us know what words you want us to cover, because this is our jam. We love this part. So we will happily do these words for you in future seasons. Tell us what you want to hear. But today we're gonna really kind of break down two specific phrases that are very common. And one of them, the first one, is one that's going to be really obvious. We say it and you're like, of course, that's terrible. And then we can talk about it. And the second one might surprise some of you a little bit more. So I'm excited for these conversations. So, Sarah, do you want to introduce our first word?
Yeah. So I think we listed this in our terrible words.
We did.
But it's incompetent cervix. And I think a lot of people don't understand what it means to have a physically incompetent birth. Body part. So tell us what it is, Katie.
Okay. So what happens with an incompetent cervix, which, by the way, we do not subscribe to this language, and we are going to offer some alternatives and talk about where they came from. But for now, we're going to use the word so you can just hear how ridiculous it is every
because
time.
That's what you would see on your chart if you were diagnosed.
That is what you would see on your chart if you were diagnosed with this. And basically what it means is that your cervix dilates early.
So if you are having a baby, let's just say we're first timers here. We've never given birth before, like what cervix dilating. I've heard about this. So when we're having a baby, you go into labor and I in most cases, people dilate to 10 centimeters before they're able to push a baby out. So if you're having a vaginal birth, your cervix is doing two different things. It's dilating and it's effacing. And so that means that one, it's shortening. So there's less space for a baby to move through the birth canal. Not a medical professional. So if you're like labor nurse mama over here and you're like, oh, one word of that was wrong, tell me in the comments, but I'm sorry. I'm not that kind of doctor. But that's basically what happens during effacement. And then dilation is the actual opening of the cervix. And so it's when you may have seen these diagrams on like Instagram or TikTok where people will show how big your cervical opening gets during labor. It's terrifying, but also like, of course it is, because it has to push not only a human head, but human shoulders out, which are wider than baby's head, right? So we're looking at a dilation of a full 10 centimeter opening in your cervix. And just like typically your cervix is not open. It's closed unless you're ovulating.
So with incompetent cervix, yes, your cervix starts opening before the baby is ready to come out.
Typically, it happens in the second trimester. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily true. It can happen anytime.
How many people does this happen to?
1 in 100.
So 1% of women.
1% of women experience incompetent cervix, and 25% of second trimester losses are from this exact issue.
Okay. So this is a thing.
It's a thing. Like, it's a real thing. I personally have not experienced it. I have a lot of people who are very close to me who have. So I have seen the ramifications of this firsthand on many, many, many occasions.
And our marketing director has it, right?
Our marketing director has it. And so if she were to have another child, she would know that at a certain stage in her pregnancy, probably around 20 to 22 weeks, she would go in for a cerclage where they literally stitch up your cervix so it cannot open. And this is also someone who's going to be much more likely to be put on some sort of modified bed rest or full bed rest, less now than in the past, because there are things you can do. You can do the cerclage. You can give progesterone, which helps with the effacement, that shortening of the cervix, and so it can keep your cervix long. But if you're under the risk of a high-risk specialist, if you're under the care of a high-risk specialist, high-risk is another word we should talk about sometime. But if you're under that kind of care, your doctor at your appointments is going to be measuring they're going to be checking to make sure you're not dilated, and they're going to be measuring the length of your cervix. And if it shortens to a certain point, you will get a cerclage. So this is what incompetent cervix refers to, a cervix that opens too early, and the baby can't typically, if it happens in the second trimester, especially early in the second trimester, the baby can't survive. And so often what happens is you end up having to deliver a baby who is stillborn because they're not able to survive the birth process. And unfortunately, because it's not something OBs are always looking for, most people don't get a diagnosis until they've experienced at least one loss. It can also be the cause of preterm labor. So babies who spend months in the NICU because they were born at 24, 25, 26 weeks, that also is very frequently, not always, but very frequently is associated with this incompetent cervix where you dilate too soon. So what does the word incompetent conjure in your mind?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think of, not even in terms of a body part, right? But just the word incompetent.
You really want to know?
I want to know. What do you think of?
You know from Home Alone where one of Kevin's sisters says you are what the French call les incompetents? I think it's Home Alone too, actually. That's what it makes me think of.
It makes me think of stupid.
It makes you think of stupid.
It's like a bullying term.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I love that.
You were incompetent at your job.
Movie.
Yes.
He was Kevin McAllister for Halloween 2 years ago. It was great.
I was Harry.
We actually all did it. Mm-hmm. We all, not together. My family collectively was Home Alone, and you and Amy were Harry and
Marv. Harry and Marv, and our dog was Kevin.
Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, for us, Jack was Kevin, and I was – well, okay, Jack was Kevin – John and Maria, our au pair, were Harry and Marv. But poor Maria, she's like, you know, 21 years old, her first Halloween in the U.S. And
she
I'm like,
just
I'm
going to
turn you into this
sexy,
guy, bald guy. not what she wore to the clubs. And then because of your idea, I was the pigeon lady from Home Alone 2.
Beautiful.
And I made Brandon a pigeon costume. So, yeah, I just made myself sound way more Pinterest mom than I am. I bought her a blue onesie and I like hot glued some feather things on. Yeah. Sure. So
it just makes me think of bullying.
It makes you think of bullying, of stupidity, of like someone who can truly just not get anything right.
So why would we apply that adjective to a literal female body part?
If not to just shame the female. Mm-hmm. Is there any other reason to do it? Like, I can't come up with one. So this is where, for us, the history of the language just gets so interesting. So this is a term that came into being. Let me just go ahead and caveat. Anytime we talk about words and the history of words on this podcast, we are pulling that information from the Oxford English Dictionary, which is the preeminent source for finding information about the English language.
Yeah, and the etymology of it.
The etymology of it, which just – can you explain what etymology means really fast?
Basically just the historical trajectory of the word.
Yes, the historical trajectory of the word. And also, funny when we're talking about reproduction, but like the morphology of it. If you break a word down into its component parts, which we're going to do in a minute, what does that mean? Like the Oxford English Dictionary, we'll call it the OED. It does all of that. So that's where all of this is coming from. If anything ever comes from a different source, we will tell you. But probably won't always say, hey, this came from the OED. So the term incompetent cervix, similar terminology began being used in the 17th century. But our first confirmed use of like really directly connected to this term was in 1865 in The Lancet, which was and still is a preeminent medical journal in the United Kingdom. And it used the word cervical incompetence. So basically, we know for a fact that this word began being used in a time when men were creating the language around women's bodies because women could not become doctors. And we also know that it's a time when male doctors were trying to dismiss the work of female midwives in homes so that women would come birth in hospitals and they would have greater power over women's bodies. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm taking a big leap here, but I just think you can't possibly imagine that the choice of the word incompetent comes from anything less than trying to show women how little control they have and how shameful their bodies can be.
Yeah, it's often called cervical insufficiency as well.
Yes, cervical insufficiency.
To be incompetent, insufficient, you're not enough.
Right, you're not enough. You can't do this on your own. So then that brings us to what do we call it? What do you call it? All right.
Yeah. So Peanut, the viral campaign
that
we mentioned earlier, suggests that we could call it early cervical dilation.
Early cervical dilation. And I like this one a lot. So Peanut did one thing that they did, like props to Peanut. I'm not going to lie. I was a little annoyed with Peanut when they came out with this campaign because
you'd been thinking of it for a while.
I had been talking about this so much and they established an advisory board and I wanted to be on it and I pitched myself to be on it and they were like, no, you're not an expert in this. And that's something I really wanted to be a part of and was very disappointed not to get to participate in, because I think having someone who is an expert in language and also has lived this experience very emotionally and understands that direct impact would be beneficial. And that's really why we're here, why we're continuing these conversations, because we want to get into those granular details. We want to look at these things deeply, and we want to help both the people who are struggling because of this language, as well as the people who could help make change with the language that we're using to make it more patient-centered. I really want them to have a much better understanding of how we could improve and why it is necessary based on my own expertise and also my own experience. I am, however, good friends with someone who was one of their experts on it, Dr. Jessica Zucker, mm-hmm. and she is actually going to be our podcast guest in two episodes where we're going to talk about all this language and its impact. And she is going to be such a fun person to talk to about this, because she is not only was a consultant on that project, but she is a reproductive psychologist. And so she is a very... we're in tune, you and I, with the language and what that language means. And we're in tune with how we have seen it affect people in the undefining mother community. But she is actually seeing patients every single day who are working through the guilt and blame and shame of these words. So that's going to be really fascinating. I like early cervical dilation that Peanut suggested. I like that the people who they did have on that board of advisors, even though I wasn't one of them, really, like, they were, it was a real, it was a well-selected board of advisors. And so I really respect a lot of the options that they came up with. Another option that has been suggested, which is very similar, is early cervical opening. And this one came from a mom who created an Instagram account trying to rename this word. And this came, she did this before the peanut thing. So her name, and I hope I'm getting this pronunciation correct, and so apologies to you, mama, if I don't, Madeline Michalik. She lost her daughter due to early cervical dilation. And she didn't know exactly why she lost her daughter at the time. She didn't get that official diagnosis until she was pregnant again. And she did an interview with Psychology Today where she talked about that experience, and it actually showed a picture of her with her daughter, who was born too early and was no longer living, which if you have the stomach for it, like, it's actually very beautiful to see, because it helps us understand how at odds these words are. I'm not going to share it because not everyone does have the stomach for it, but it's in Psychology Today. If you Google Psychology Today and competent cervix, you can find it if you are someone who would like to sort of honor that little girl and her mom, and reckon a little bit with how at odds these terms are. So she was at her high-risk specialist appointment, and he measured the length of her cervix, and he exclaimed, "You have an incompetent cervix." And they scheduled an emergency cerclage, which is where they stitch your cervix up, hold it together. And she carried that pregnancy to term, and so, she birthed that baby.
Pregnancy after.
Yes. So this was her pregnancy after loss. And it would, if she had not been under that high risk care because of the first loss, it would have been another loss. But this doctor found it. He scheduled an emergency cerclage. She carried that baby to term. That baby was healthy. But what she said in her Psychology Today interview just resonated so, so heavily with me. She said, and like, I have to read to get this exactly right for you. She said, "Despite the happy ending, I continued to feel the guilt imparted by that diagnosis." And it's guilt over your body. It's guilt over the loss of that first child. It's guilt over the risk to the next child. It's guilt over feeling like you're a failure. I've noticed on their Instagram account, they post a lot of content that says things like, "Your cervix is not incompetent. You are not a failure. Mm-hmm. You are not defective. You are worthy." Really highlighting the need to help moms understand.
Yeah.
Because this language is so hurtful.
Can I just say to you, like, while we're talking about one specific body part causing pregnancy complications or infertility, like, you would never, like, if you got a kidney stone, right? Like, you would never, or a gallstone. Let's do gallbladder.
Gallstone's
right?
easier.
If you get gallstones, no one would say, oh, your gallbladder is incompetent. We have to take it out. You just take it out. If your appendix was about to rupture, they would just take it out.
Right. You, if your appendix is about to rupture, you have appendicitis. You do not have an incompetent appendix.
That came to me.
It's really important.
Right. But when we talk about carrying a baby, suddenly that blame is back on the woman.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, exactly.
But if you had appendicitis, like, no big deal.
Right. So, and then we want to talk about one that's a little less obvious, because we want to make sure we understand, like, how deeply we can break this all down. And then we're going to go somewhere with it where we can give you some, like, actual, here are some things we can do, okay? So the less obvious one, I have talked about this many times before. So if you're coming over from Instagram or our website or our newsletter, you have heard this before. Miscarriage. Miscarriage is a word I have experienced a lot and I have researched a lot. And I personally choose to call it pregnancy loss. In fact, I have a hashtag, call it pregnancy loss. I do often use miscarriage simply because it's the word that people understand and it's the word that often people are searching for when they're looking for support. But I do want us to think about how even this word actually is something that blames the mom, right? Okay. So I've done a lot of research on this. One definition of miscarriage from the OED from the 16th century, okay? So we are 1500s. We are 500 years ago. Failure, blunder, or mistake.
That one reminds me of the phrase miscarriage of justice, right?
Yes.
Like when someone gets off the hook for something they've done.
Exactly. Exactly. Miscarriage of justice is the primary other use of miscarriage historically as well. So these two things have been used together. I mean, not together, but like, you know, at the same time a lot. Another, still from 500 years ago, the spontaneous expulsion of a fetus from the womb before it is viable. So for 500 years, miscarriage has meant the spontaneous expulsion of a fetus before it's viable and failure, blunder, mistake. So listed separately, but then conflating them together from the get-go, this spontaneous expulsion has always, always been a failure, right? And a failure of what? A failure of whom? To me, that failure seems to apply to the mother. The other reason that I think that this word is at one point maybe was intended to place blame on the mother. Well, we've already talked about like all of the things that doctors used to blame women for miscarrying and how publicly they blame them. So that certainly plays a role in my belief here, okay? But also, we can break the word down. So we've given you some etymology, some history of the word. We can break it down morphologically. We can put it in its component parts. And so miscarriage comes from two parts, mis and carriage or carry. It's of Germanic origin, where mis is a prefix, so a section of a word that comes at the beginning that changes the definition of that word. And that mis as a Germanic prefix suggests that the word describes something that was, and these are quotes, handled badly, wrongly, or even perversely.
Yikes.
And carriage refers to the actual carrying of a fetus. So we carry a baby, we carry to term, or
you carry badly.
Or perversely.
Mm-hmm. That one's awful.
And people don't even know that this is a thing. So what I have talked about many times is I have said, when we use the word miscarriage, we are saying that a woman has carried badly. And I actually get a lot of pushback when I talk about this, a lot of it, because people say, I don't feel guilted by the word miscarriage. And I think that's a fair response, right? Just because it doesn't make you feel a sense of guilt or shame doesn't mean the word.
It's not wrong.
Right. It doesn't mean the word doesn't have that origin and doesn't make some people feel that way. But I, my personal preference, and I believe this is what Peanut suggested in their glossary as well, is pregnancy loss. And that is my preference. That is the preference I've found of most of the undefining motherhood community, which is a pretty large sample size. But I have had people make really interesting comments. Like, you know, when my doctor said it was a miscarriage, I was able to view that as a medical thing.
Hmm.
And kind of keep my distance from it. And then when you tell me it was a pregnancy loss, all of a sudden I'm struck by how much I lost.
And it's still part of this larger lexicon, right?
Like, right.
This lexicon that builds a narrative that our bodies are doing something wrong.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so I think that's what we really want to for you to take away from this episode as listeners is that there is this full lexicon that was created not by women about women's bodies, and it's one of its most vulnerable stages, arguably its most vulnerable stage, in a way that is really shaming them and really, really hurting them. The other thing we want to talk about here is that this actually matters, right?
Yeah.
Right? Because I get that a lot. When I, like, I put this stuff on Instagram and it goes viral, and then I get all of these trolls saying, these are just words. Words don't matter. Words don't matter. Like, sticks and stones. Okay. First of all, They do. If anyone has ever talked about you behind your back, the words hurt. Mm-hmm. If anyone ever calls you out on something directly, it hurts. My six-year-old doesn't come home from school crying when someone hit him. He comes home from school crying when someone says something cruel or unkind. Luckily, that's rare. But it shows us from these earliest ages that words do hurt us. Mm-hmm. I can attest from having worked with thousands of moms going through this experience that the words hurt. I can attest from my own experience, and you're going to hear a lot more about this next week, that the words hurt. But also, we have direct evidence about it in a way that I think is really, really, really important. So in 2018, there was a study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, and it brought together researchers from, I believe, four or five different institutions, Johns Hopkins, University of Chicago, et cetera, et cetera. So really very, very interesting study. And the results, what they were looking at is literally the title is Do Words Matter? Mm-hmm. And their question is, do words matter in medical care? And the primary thing that they were looking at is sickle cell anemia, which I think is something we're actually going to come back to that. But the findings were significant beyond that specific thing, and they wanted them to be. Like, they were trying to understand on a larger scale. The results of this study, in their own words, I'm reading directly, exposure to the stigmatizing language note was associated with more negative attitudes toward the patient. So note meaning in a medical chart. Language toward the patient meaning by the doctor. So what they add at the end, and this one is, I think, clearer for the everyday listener or reader, attention to the language used in medical records may help promote patient-centered care and to reduce healthcare disparities for stigmatized populations.
Yeah. So when you take the language out of that kind of clinical, you know, space and put it toward a more empathetic patient-centered approach, you automatically influence nurses and doctors to treat those patients with more empathy.
Exactly.
Right? It makes sense.
Exactly. So doctors OBs see miscarriage every single day. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people in our community report to me how dismissed they felt by their care team because it's just routine for that doctor. And I get that. That's fair.
There's a person behind that.
Imagine the difference if a doctor has to walk into your room and say, I'm sorry you're losing this pregnancy.
Rather than I'm sorry you're having a miscarriage.
Uh-huh. Like,
I'm sorry your cervix is incompetent.
Right. Like, I can't – I just inherently feel more empathy happening in that room just from that language.
Yeah.
And so that's why talking about this matters, because we can make change. ACOG has shown it. We still got to get there with, you know, that insurance coding. But, like, we've seen that the change can happen. We've got the evidence to show – that for better patient-centered care, the language is important. So we need to be talking about these things. And there's one other word in here that I really want to make sure we
can. Can I make a real quick point, though?
Yeah.
I feel like this is even more important when we're talking about marginalized populations because, you know, non-Hispanic Black women have a 2.6% higher this is really important. The maternal mortality rate for non-Hispanic Black mothers is 2.6 times higher, not 2.6%. So
right. 2.6 if we can, times.
Right. If we can influence the way that doctors and medical practitioners speak towards women who are not white, we have a greater chance of influencing Black maternal mortality.
The care that they're getting, the empathy that they're receiving. And now I don't have to make my point because that was it. Because it's great. What I had wanted to point out was that the language of this study specifically said reduce healthcare disparities for stigmatized populations. And I think that's why it's important that they were studying sickle cell as one of their primary studies, because that is most common in Black non-Hispanic populations.
So why don't we talk about men this way? Is what I really want to know.
Why don't we talk about men this way? Because women weren't allowed to be doctors and they weren't making the language. And I like to hope that maybe we would have had the empathy to make better language, right? Mm-hmm. But let's close on a light note, right? Because this has been – it's been a heavy one. So let's close on something lighter. You know, if women had been under the same sort of mental – if we had the same goals, the same matriarchal goals that we know the patriarchal structure was working within when they were creating these terms in the previous hundreds of years and the men were creating these terms, what would we call some of these male concerns that specifically, very clearly do not have negative derogatory?
This is a good game. I'm excited.
Good game. Yeah. All right. So.
Katie. What would you call erectile dysfunction?
Erectile dysfunction. I would have to call either, and like no offense, men, I'm pretending this is 200 years ago and we're trying to use this language. We don't want you to have this language, right? But if women had been in charge and using this kind of language that men chose, it would be either an incompetent penis or failure to perform.
I love it.
That's what it would be. All right. What's something non-sexual? It's just a common thing for men. What about male pattern baldness?
Follicular failure.
Follicular failure. Oh, my gosh. I love it. Yes. But I think we get really good ideas when we do think about the reproductive ones, because that is how men were making this language, right?
And so, in our research on this, too, I think it's important to note that we just don't see adjectives like poor or words like incompetent or failed. They just don't exist when we talk about male reproductive bodies.
Exactly. Like we have in some everyday parlance things that we say, right? Like slow swimmers.
Sure.
The medical phrase is low sperm motility. Mm-hmm. And that is not derogatory. But the way we're talking about the culture is derogatory.
The same kind of way.
And so it's not to say that men are completely immune from this, but it is to say the medical language for men is very clearly less stigmatizing, less shaming, less derogatory than for women. Okay. So let's just do one or two more if we have an M. All right. Low sperm count.
Impotent seed quality.
Seed quality. Oh, my
I think you
goodness.
Should end on your Legally Blonde reference.
I'm going to. Yeah. We did not know that season one of this podcast was going to be about Legally Blonde references, but here we are. So you remember the classroom scene in Legally Blonde where Elle Woods has been really struggling and she has finally, like, she's buckled down and she's studied and she is ready to prove herself. And she's, like, up against Warren talking about this case where a male sperm donor is trying to seek custody rights. And Warren's job is to argue that he should get them, and Elle's job is to argue that he should not. And she makes some good point that honestly seems like a good enough point to end on. And then, of course, in her over-the-top way, she just, like, throws on this whammy that is hilarious and laughable, but also makes
really smart.
The professor yeah. say, I think you've just won yeah. your case. She says, every masturbatory emission could be termed reckless abandonment. Right?
Binding.
So I decided if we were holding men to the same derogatory standards in our medical terminology, one, would we be legislating masturbation? Gotta wonder. Because it could simply be termed total fertilization failure. And that one, my friend, is a really sad one to bring up because that is a real term mm-hmm. in assisted reproductive technology. So there
you go.
We have it. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Undefining Motherhood podcast. It's been an honor to share this time with you. Remember, you're not just a listener, you're an essential part of our community. If today's conversation resonated with you, I have three simple requests for how you can help us grow. First, subscribe wherever you listened so you don't miss an episode. Second, we'd love it if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast, as that's one of the most important ways we can grow and share our message and community. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. Jump over to Instagram and find us at Undefining Motherhood, where you'll see a post about this week's episode where we can continue the conversation. Thank you for being a part of the Undefining Motherhood community, where together we're making change. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.